Bury this, Mycroft, Ando ordered. You have Martin's ear, and the Commissioner General's. Bury this before it plunges the hive back into Chinese monopoly for another 50 years. I'll do my best, Chief Director, and keep Tycoon away from the members of the Senea Weeks Booth, Bash. You may not recognize this Mitsubishi nickname, reader, but Ando means the head of Martin's team, J.E.D.D. Mason. Since there are too many reasons for Ando's nervousness to list here, I will say simply that J.E.D.D. Mason is trusted of Ando, trusted like a son, but still a bit too close to Martin's emperor. I'll do my best, Chief Director, but you know I only serve. I have no power to decide. Danae broke in. We know you'll always do your best for us, good Mycroft. I can't express quite how, since there was no threat in her words, but something in her tone, her smile, spoke of my parole. How now she could shatter it at any instant with just 3 words to the Commissioner General. Only the packaging. I shuddered, and the Chief Director seemed contented by my fear. Then you may go begin. Thank you, Chief Director. I scrambled up and bowed, but felt my failure as the couple turned away, the new leash around my neck called blackmail. I could not leave myself or those who depended on me so deeply in their power. There was no resort but French. Do you know who else came to the Bash House today, Princesse? Apart from Martin? Both turned, and the princess relaxed at the music of her birth Bash tongue, returning slow French syllables which flowed from her lips like kisses. There was someone else? I could not guess whether her ignorance was feigned or real. There was a certain sensei. I scanned the back room to confirm that Michi Mitsubishi, the one adopted child interning with Europe and likely to know French, was absent. It was safe to press on. A foster child. Dark blonde, blue eyes. I searched Danae's face, but the illusion of eternal youth, which masks the matron's decades, masks fear lines also. A gag gene, I added. 28 years old. A statue of cream-white marble seemed to stand before me in that instant, so rigid she became. I felt my hands twitch with the impulse to catch her should she faint. What a marvelous world, she whispered it, less to me than to the world itself, and her lashes fluttered, fighting back a tear. You did not know? I have to ask, Princesse. I'm sorry. Danae stepped toward me, away from her husband, who frowned but backed away, respectful of his bride's right to her separate tongue and separate sphere. I have never known him. She brought her alabaster hands up to her breast, as if cradling an infant, real again in her fingers' memory. I glanced back to the inner chamber where her many adopted children sprawled and stared, all so different. Hiroaki Mitsubishi, with Thai features, June, European, pale and freckled, Ron with Middle Eastern tints like Martin, but none like their mother. No one had been surprised when Ando, proud of his pure Japanese breeding, and Danae, just as proudly French, had adopted instead of mixing their blood. But still, to have held a child of her body for a day and never again, even imagining it made me ache. You must at least have asked where he was taken to be raised, I asked. What hive he joined? Another tear-gilded blink. No, nothing. It was judged kindest that way. Who took the child away? His Grace, your brother? Your honored husband? I avoided the French for Chief Director, since even Ando could recognize that. It was handed to the doctor. The ghost of a smile softened her sadness. He didn't cry, brave little one. I told him nothing. I'm sure he doesn't know. It was the best comfort I could offer. Thank you. Her thanks warmed me, made me bold. I found it hard to believe that he, of all senseirs in the world, would be sent to that Bosch by chance. Can you think of anyone who might have traced him? Any reason anyone could have to dredge this up after so long? To embroil him in this mess with the theft and the device? Three times she parted her lips. A different syllable shaped each time, but only the third time did she voice it. Is he happy? I lowered my eyes. It was the right question, the only real question a loving heart would ask. And had she had a different upbringing, it might have been hard to answer. The patriarch wrote that the half-wit is always happier than the philosopher. But the philosopher would not trade knowledge for ignorance, not for all the happiness in the world. Your son seemed to me half a philosopher, but still half happy. Do you know the reference, reader? Or does your age, forgetful of its past, no longer know Le Patriarche by that worthy epithet? Have you forgotten the first pen stronger than swords? The firebrand who spread reason's light across the earth, battled intolerance, religious persecution, torture, forced kings to bow before the rights of man, and introduced wit into philosophy again? Is Aristotle not still known by the honorable title of the philosopher? Shakespeare, the bard, Brill, the cognitivist? How then can you forget the patriarch? Perhaps you protest, thou accusest me unjustly, Mycroft. History has not swallowed this great man, rather he has swallowed history. I do not know who created the first government or built the first wheel. It is so ubiquitous that I do not need to. Just so, my better era does not teach me who first fought for these good heresies you list, for they are now truths, and the blind age that doubted them is well forgotten. Perhaps you are right, reader. It is honor, not dishonor, if you forget the patriarch. We now doubt Aristotle, understand Shakespeare only with footnotes, poke holes in Brill. But the patriarch, whom all earth follows without thinking there could be another way, he has indeed swallowed us up. But he has not so swallowed Danae, reared as she was, as if in his own age, when he, her patriarch, needed defending. Voltaire, reader, the patriarch of the 18th century, the era which has just remade your own. It was Voltaire. A lady of Danae's education knows the corpus of the patriarch by heart. A good answer, Mycroft. Heartache's remnants gave her French a somber tint. Thank you. If he has been drawn into this by some cruel manipulator, I know you will protect him. I had meant to trade blackmail for blackmail here, but instead found myself drawn into pity for Danae and for young Carlyle, too. My mind buzzed with measures to protect them, the lady from the enemies of Mitsubishi and Japan, the senseir from the stern major, from overcautious Thisbe, from himself. Mistakes he might make in the first giddy hours after meeting Bridger. That thought warmed me, the strange, sideways kindness of Providence, which had stripped the gag gene of Bosch and past and family, only to give him a treasure which was, to any senseir, 1,000 times more precious, a miracle. Actually, Princess, I think he has both much knowledge and much happiness, at least where it matters. If some brave painter captured her smile on canvas, it would draw crowds down the centuries. Thank you. Then again, in Japanese, for all to hear, thank you, Mycroft. And we must thank my dear brother for calling you and Martin in to solve this. I know all feel safer in your hands. Director Ando nodded my dismissal, and Princess Danae passed me my servicer's reward at last, a round lunchbox, tied and too heavy to be anything but sushi. My many masters don't always remember they must feed me, that their toil earned handouts are the only sustenance permitted to we, the unfree. But Danae, this monster from a more barbaric time, always remembers the protocols of servitude. Chapter the Fifth. Aristotle's House. I muse sometimes about where else in history I might have picked to be a slave, if I had had my choice. I could have been a slave in Aristotle's house when he reared Alexander. I could have midwived at the birth of Caesar. As a slave convict, I might have added my sweat-drenched kilometer to the railroads that saddled the great continents, my heaven-bound cable to the first space elevator, or sweated in the rigging of the Santa Maria as she erased the dragons at the world's end and knit the whole sphere closed. If we count apprenticeship as an unfreedom, I might have been the typesetter who forged Newton's Principia, letter by letter, with his own black fingers, or the clerk who brought the coffee to Brill's circle as the master ranted into the wee hours with silent Cullen in the corner, already dreaming of her boshes. In any of these servitudes, I would probably have cursed the great works I touched, the great men I called masters, nor would knowing they were great have lessened my suffering one toil-smeared jot. Yet somehow the idea warms me that out of every 1,000 lives of suffering my ancient counterparts endured, one slave was building something that his soul, if it could view all from outside of time, might call great. It cannot balance the pain, but it does console me just a little, and for me, a little is enough. I was scrubbing spilled perfume from Thisbe's bedroom floor when Carlyle Foster made his timid way back to the Sinéad Weeksbooth Bosch house. I watched him through the security system, which, for Bridger's safety, Thisbe let me access. He started toward the little stair to Thisbe's door again, but the main door opened for him, beckoning him across the walkway to the front hall, dark and empty. I see you, you salty yellow ball of light. Come in. The words appeared as text in Carlyle's lenses, and the log of them makes it easy for me to reconstruct the scene. Come in, I said. In, in, in. The sensei tiptoed across the walkway and peered into the Spartan trophy hall. Hello? Why are you back? Mycroft said you'd be back, but you don't come back. Totally out of pattern. Did you leave something behind? Mycroft said I'd be back. Carlyle crept along the empty hall, nervous as a new cat. They said to tell you they're downstairs. They didn't say why you'd be back. Did you forget something? You don't leave your things very often. September 2nd, 51 is the last I have. Carlyle's breath caught when he reached the central room where Mukta hung in her place of honor, looking so like the textbooks. Or perhaps it was the two people sprawled on the floor who made him gasp. Both wore time-scuffed bathrobes over bodysuits of transparent conducting film, tight as a second skin. Thin, molded helmets covered their scalps and ears, and a strip of plastic taut across the eyes kept the real world's light from interfering with the computers. The films over their limbs were pocked by the round red spots of tactile feedback discs, positioned far apart on the less discerning surfaces of shoulders and fleshy thighs, but dense as strawberry seeds on the nerve-packed skin of hands and faces, where a millimeter's difference is perceptible. One of the two snored softly, but the other waved. Hello? Carlyle smiled. Hello, you must be member Eureka Weeksbooth? Bingo. Perhaps Carlyle could see Eureka's subtle wiggles as they texted, or perhaps he thought he could. And that's member Sidney Coons? Carlyle gestured to the sleeping one before remembering Eureka could not see. You've read up on us,